Coming up today, is there a spiritual awakening in England leaving behind what was the new atheism? British author and podcaster Justin Brierley joins us.
Atheism, in a sense, because it is just a negative statement about something, it wasn't able to offer a positive vision of flourishing for people. And the architects of the movement just ended up, you know, disagreeing with each other in the end.
Then, who's behind the push for anti-Zionism in the U.S.? And why should Christians support the modern state of Israel? We'll get some great insight from Dr. A.J. Nolte of Regent University.
If you're saying that Zionism is racism, what you are effectively saying is that for Israel to not be a racist society, it would have to no longer exist as a Jewish state.
It's the weekend of June 22nd and 23rd. I'm Jeff Shambly, and this is The Stand Radio. England was once a beacon for the gospel, sending out missionaries like William Carey, James Hudson Taylor, and producing preachers like Charles Haddon Spurgeon and John Wesley. But over the decades, secularism and materialism have left empty churches in their wake, and England, like much of Western Europe, is a mission field itself today. But is that changing? Some people are seeing a rebirth of belief in God. Justin Brierley is one of those. He's a broadcaster in the United Kingdom, as well as an author and speaker who's the host of the Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God podcast and has written a new book by the same title. He's joining us now from his home in Surrey, England. Justin, welcome to The Stand Radio.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be with you.
Justin, we've seen a long time the decline of Christianity in Western Europe and the rise of materialism, but you're writing in this book that the tide is changing. What leads you to that conclusion?
Well, I've been hosting conversations here in the UK for over 17 or 18 years now between Christians and non-Christians. And really, the show that I hosted, Unbelievable, for many years kind of put Christians opposite the new atheists. These were very dogmatic anti-religious types like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. And that was the tenor of the debate for many years. But I did notice in the last few years that a change in the tone of the conversation. Many more people, even if they didn't call themselves Christians or believers, willing to accept the value of Christianity, to say that actually we've lost something without our Christian heritage in the UK and in the West generally. And I just noticed a new openness, actually. That was partly because the new atheism itself kind of imploded on itself and didn't really answer people's questions. But I was also noticing lots of these interesting people like Jordan Peterson, the well-known psychologist, talking in very favorable terms about Christianity, and even some very surprising adult converts to Christianity. And all of this gave me the sense that actually something has changed in our culture, that as we've approached a kind of what I call in the book a meaning crisis, right, where people are looking for a story to make sense of their life again, actually there are ears that are freshly open to hear the message of Christianity. Even as you say, in a country so very secular and post-Christian as the UK, I'm surprised to see actually some really interesting things happening at the moment.
Yeah, Justin, you mention in your book that crisis of meaning, and you relate that to the new atheism. Some people might not be familiar with that term. Would you describe what is new atheism and what has it done to people?
Well, I would say what was new atheism now, because I honestly do believe it's something in the past to some extent. But in the mid-2000s, it was this very strong, dogmatic, quite aggressive form of non-belief. And so you had the so-called four horsemen of new atheism. These were scientists like Richard Dawkins, the journalist Christopher Hitchens, public thinkers like Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett. They each had their own best-selling anti-God book. They were found on many stages all over the world. They had TV shows. And it was just a general kind of sense in the atmosphere that religion was just fairy tales, superstition, and was bad for you. That was the message that they were propounding. And so this was very much kind of what dominated the airwaves for a long time in our public culture. There was even here in the UK an atheist bus campaign, you know, these red London buses bearing the slogan, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." But that was, as I said, the reason I say that was the phenomenon of new atheism is because I do honestly believe it's really over now. I don't think they ultimately offered the answers people were looking for in life. And that's why, in many ways, their audiences have turned to these new thinkers who are far more open to the value of Christianity. As I say, people like Jordan Peterson and others. And I think that, as I say, the movement itself kind of imploded on itself. And I kind of watched this with interest from the sidelines, if you like, as I was hosting these conversations. Because once they'd agreed that God didn't exist and religion is bad for you, they couldn't agree on anything else. And they started to go up to war with each other over issues around social justice, LGBT, feminism, because some people wanted to take this atheist movement in a very sort of social justice sort of direction. They called it Atheism Plus. But there were others who were very against that. They felt this was just political ideology coming into the movement. And so this led to some huge arguments, even within the new atheism, to the point where people were no longer willing to share a stage with each other, falling out with each other dramatically. Even Richard Dawkins, the chief architect of this movement, had his Humanist of the Year award stripped from him by the American Humanist Association because of his views on transgender. So it was interesting to see the way in which atheism, in a sense, because it is just a negative statement about something, it wasn't able to offer a positive vision of flourishing for people. And the architects of the movement just ended up, you know, disagreeing with each other in the end.
That's fascinating. That is fascinating. Speaking of Richard Dawkins, he made headlines recently by saying that although he doesn't hold to any of the Christian doctrines or parts of the Christian faith, he was kind of a cultural Christian. That is, he loved the hymns. He loved the ethos of the Christian faith. Let me ask you this. We also know that there's a growing influence of Islam in Western Europe overall. How much of this turning toward God might be a reaction to the growth of Islam?
Well, I think that that's a very good point you're making there, because when Richard Dawkins had this viral interview in which he described himself as a cultural Christian, it was in the context of him being somewhat concerned at the fact that Ramadan was being promoted in public and train stations and public areas and so on. Yeah. And specifically, he said, I would much rather, if you like, hold on to the Christian heritage of this country than for Islam to come in and take over, if you like. So what's so interesting here, Jeff, is that actually when Dawkins says that, you know, I appreciate the cultural aspects of Christianity. Firstly, that's a big change in tone from the way he was talking about Christianity only 10 or 15 years ago, in which it was the root of all evil and everything else. Now, suddenly, there are some good things, it turns out, about our Christian heritage. The other thing I want to say, though, to Richard Dawkins is, you can't have the fruit without the root. You can't enjoy the lovely cathedrals and carols and, you know, ethos if there aren't people actually becoming Christians to sustain it. So he's sort of trying to saw the branch off that he's sitting on. You know, it's a very strange and contradictory position he finds himself in. But I think you're absolutely right. I think to some extent his new appreciation of the value of Christianity does stem from his fear of Islam. And this is very interesting because one of his great friends, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who was herself one of the original new atheists. She was a Somali-born woman who kind of came out of extremist Islam in Somalia, but adopted a very strong atheism as her response to that. She rejected all religion and she shared stages with the new atheists. Yet only about 6 months ago, she announced that she had become a Christian. And this was a shock to everyone, not least Richard Dawkins, who was absolutely flabbergasted that his great friend and atheist, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, was now embracing Christianity. And the reason she gave in the article she wrote was that, A, she felt that only Christianity could provide a kind of defense against what she saw as the dangers of things like fundamentalist Islam, woke ideologies, the great sort of powers that are threatening the world in terms of Putin, China. She had come to realize that atheism simply did not have the resources to do that. It was so weak because it had nothing to offer. Mm-hmm. It could not stand against these other forces. And she realized just how powerful the Judeo-Christian heritage was in doing that. And she also said she had her own meaning crisis. She was she was depressed. She was virtually suicidal. And it was only when she opened herself up to the possibility that there may be a God and that God may be made known in Jesus Christ that suddenly she found she could hold on to something. So that's just a classic example of someone who absolutely has sort of seen the dangers of Islam and the weakness of secularism and is now one of these very, very surprising converts to Christianity.
Hmm. Another individual who's no doubt had a great impact is John Lennox. He's a well-known mathematician at Oxford University. He's debated many atheists on the existence of God from a philosophical and scientific point of view. Is that kind of bold stance having an effect in removing some intellectual blocks for people there in the UK?
Well, I'm so glad for people like John Lennox because I think he's just had such a tremendous influence, especially in the latter years of his life. He was, for most of his life, a sort of Oxford academic, mathematician, professor of the philosophy of science. I've come to know him quite well in the last 10 to 15 years, and he has been an amazing sort of communicator, intellectual, and able to put ideas across accessibly. And had, some significant debates with people like Richard Dawkins. So yeah, I think that's been an important part of, if you like, the move against New Atheism was people like John Lennox, but you could add other great Christian thinkers like William Lane Craig and many others who have really stepped up to the challenge that the New Atheist delivered and given really good intellectual reasons why Christianity makes sense, why there is no conflict between science and faith, as the New Atheist claimed. So I'm very thankful for people like John Lennox, but I was with John only a few days ago for a conference, and he's getting on in years. He will say this himself. And so I think w the challenge for Christians is to find who is the next John Lennox, the next, mind like his, and how can we all actually be our own sort of John Lennox, showing that actually Christianity is an absolutely intellectually defensible option. In fact, it's the best option of all the options out there. It's the best story that you could ever tell because it not only makes sense of the world around us, it makes sense of ourselves as well, our own search for meaning and purpose. So for me, yeah, I celebrate John Lennox, but he won't be with us forever, and we need to make sure we're doing the work that he's begun.
Speak to that a little bit, because I think people in the U.S., I've heard this said many times, that wherever England is, America is 10 years behind it. So if that's the case in the U.K., that there is a rebirth of belief in God, that materialism and naturalism have left a void, which it does, then what kinds of questions should we be asking to people who now are open to the existence of God and then leading them to Jesus Christ?
I think that sometimes we get stuck answering the questions of a bygone era. And while it's important to respond to some of those key questions, like, is there evidence for God? What about suffering? Give me some evidence for the resurrection. These were the kinds of, objections, if you like, that were being leveled by the new atheists. I think actually, because the conversation has changed in our culture, there are some slightly different questions that are being asked. And so it's important to respond to those. And I think what we see, as I say, because of this meaning crisis in our culture, because people are looking for a story to make sense of their lives, because the stories they're holding on to aren't making sense, if they're running after, certain gender identities and sexualities as an answer to the deep longing in themselves. They might be looking to a political ideology to try to make sense of life. None of these were meant to take the place of God. And so I think the thing for the church is to show why Christianity is the most beautiful story you could hope to live in. And the questions people are asking now, I think, are more about, give me a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Help me to make sense of what life is about. I see so many, especially young men, who are kind of experiencing something like an identity crisis because they've been given so many mixed messages by the world. They don't know what it means is to be a man. And that's why they're turning to these gurus like Jordan Peterson, frankly. It's because they're looking for identity. They're looking for a father figure. They're looking for some kind of stability. Now, interestingly, he's one of the people pointing them back to the scriptures to say, even though Jordan Peterson himself is, it's hard to pin down where he is, to be honest, on faith and God. But he's opened the door for a significant number of people to take Christianity seriously. I know a number of young men who have become Christians because they started listening to Jordan Peterson, and he kind of made it intellectually acceptable to take this seriously. So I think the church needs to be ready, looking at some of these prophets, if you like, from outside the church, and trying to understand, well, why are they attracting such large crowds? What are the questions they're answering? How can we be offering the true and beautiful picture of Jesus that is actually the ultimate answer to all of these longings? So that's my hope, is to kind of really key in now on these existential questions that people are asking.
Wonderful. Our guest today is Justin Brierley. He's the author of the new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, and hosts a podcast by the same name. If you'd like to get the book, we encourage you to do that. Go to christianbook.com. And also, you can get the book as well as his podcast episodes at the website justinbrierley.com. Brierley is spelled Brierley, justinbrierley.com. Justin, thank you so much for sharing with us today what's going on. It's very exciting, and we hope and pray that the same thing will happen here in America.
Well, bless you, Jeff. And they say that the US is only 10 years behind the UK, as you said, but I believe God hasn't given up on the UK. You know, yeah. often God works in right. ways where an unexpected revival is around the corner. I just have a feeling we might be in one of those moments. So pray for us. We'll pray for you. And thank you so much for talking to me.
Anti-Semitism has been a growing problem around the world since the October 7th attacks on Israel by Hamas and Israel's response to that in Gaza. Anti-Jewish sentiment is rampant on college campuses, but one university is setting itself apart by showing the providential hand of God in the modern nation of Israel and supporting that with scholarly research. We're talking about the newly formed Institute for Israel Studies at Regent University, and joining me is its chair, Dr. A.J. Nolte. He's also assistant professor of government there at the Robertson School at Regent. Dr. Nolte, welcome to the Stand Radio.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
This is exciting. Tell us about how this idea came about for forming the Institute for Israel Studies.
Yeah, thanks. So actually, this is something that I had thought about for quite some time. I started teaching at Regent in 2017, and there's a real interest in and passion for Israel among Christian students, but not always as much knowledge or understanding of some of the complexities of the modern nation state of Israel. And I thought, well, boy, we really could do more here to educate folks about that. And I think there are a lot of opportunities for universities to partner with some of the world-class universities in Israel. So I was seeing this mostly as a positive. This is going to be great for Regent. Let's start working on this. You know, talk to Dean Bachman about it. When she came on board in 2021, we started thinking and praying about it. But as I got more into this, and as I got connected with some of my Jewish colleagues in particular around the country who are at some of the more elite universities, what I was finding was that actually it wasn't just a mission to Christian universities, but that actually campus anti-Semitism was increasing at a rapid pace. And was tied in with a lot of these left-wing, post-colonial, almost Marxist ideas. And so I realized we really need to counter this in the academic space. And so our planning and our discussions on that intensified. But it was after, of course, October 7th that people saw the reaction on so many college campuses, where instead of candlelight vigils in support of Israel, instead of prayers for the victims or people calling for a return of the hostages, we almost immediately saw all of these campus organizations come out in solidarity with the with Hamas and with Gaza, and criticizing Israel for genocide before the first military action that Israel even took.
Yeah.
And so that really, I think, kicked this into high gear, and something that was an opportunity or valuable just became indispensable. And so we were lucky enough to have a gracious donor reach out at the end of last year and the beginning of this year. And we've been this year putting together the proposal, taking it through our process at Regent, and we're glad to announce the Institute. And I would say, in a sense, it was providential timing. It's God's timing that our press release came out not too long after things really escalated at Columbia. Yes. And so God has a funny way of of timing that out.
What you said about anti-Semitism is exactly right. It's almost eerie how vehement this rhetoric has become, and some physical violence as well. Let me give you some stats here. The American Israeli Cooperative Enterprise came out with a study back in May of last year where they studied the number of dollars going into universities. Arab countries have funneled billions into these universities. I'll give you an example. Number one is Cornell University, $1.8 billion. Georgetown, $830 million. Texas A&M, $806 million. And of course, Qatar and Saudi Arabia are the biggest funders of this. Dr. Nolte, how much anti-Semitism on college campuses do you think comes from this kind of influence?
Boy, I think that's a hugely important point. And there are two related but separate factors that are driving campus anti-Semitism. First is the one that you mentioned, Qatar and Saudi Arabia in particular. Now, also keeping in mind that sometimes that's the government, but sometimes that is wealthy members of those societies who may have their own interests or agenda. So, for example, you'll see the number for Georgetown from Saudi Arabia, but a lot of that comes from a guy by the name of Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, And Al-Walid bin Talal is by no means a fan of or on positive terms with the current Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. They have had significant political differences in the past. And a lot of the donations by Al-Walid bin Talal are certainly funding an anti-Israel sentiment. I would say Middle East studies in particular is heavily influenced by this money. And if you look at Qatar in particular, which is number one, look at what they've been doing in the region since 2011, 2012. They've backed every Muslim Brotherhood government that has come about. They've been hosting Hamas. They've been, you know, certainly benefiting from their role in the Gulf Cooperation Council, but also kind of playing both sides against the middle with some of those Islamist forces. The second factor, because I think the Middle East studies and the funding there is important, and it's part of the reason why any pro-Israel effort is going to desperately need the support of biblically faithful Christians, because we're going to be outspent hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of times to one, even if we do really well on fundraising. But the other factor that's really important, and you have to kind of dig to find this, is there's been a longstanding left-wing anti-Zionism that I would consider to be anti-Semitic, that actually has its origins from the Soviet Union from the 1970s. And as they were concerned about their own Jewish population starting to be influenced by Zionism and lured away from communism, they created a branch of anti-Zionist science. And they, in fact, are the ones who pushed the Zionism as racism stuff at the United Nations. So a lot of the left has actually unknowingly been captured by this particular mode of thought that has its origins in the Soviet Union. Anti-Zionist science, as I understand it, talking to one of my colleagues who's an expert on this, kind of produced by the KGB. So when you have that combination of left-wing Marxist sort of post-communist anti-Zionism with the pro-Islamist leaning elements that you're getting from funding from Qatar, you have a toxic stew that is hopefully will allow your listeners to make a little bit more sense of some of the craziness that we're seeing on campuses.
Yeah, that makes sense. Dr. Nolte, would you give us a working definition of Zionism? Because if you do a simple search online, you get a lot of different things. For our purposes and in terms of an evangelical audience, what would Zionism be?
Yeah, I think that's really important for us to understand because there's so much misinformation about Zionism. If you watch some of those videos on YouTube where they ask the protesters, what do you think Zionism is? They'll say things like, well, it's the idea that they should exterminate Palestinians or something like that. Zionism actually has a very simple and pretty clearly agreed upon definition. It is the idea that the Jewish people have a right to autonomy within their own independent state. It is the idea that the Jewish people, much like Americans or Germans or Frenchmen or Greeks, have a right to their own national state. And Zionism in particular has, and this is where the biblical component comes in, has really drawn on the idea that that state ought to be in the historic homeland of the Jewish people, which for us as Christians, we would say, ties in biblically because that is this historic and biblical homeland of the Jewish people. So certainly not all Zionists are religious. Not all Zionists are even necessarily devout religious Orthodox Jews. It starts out actually as a nationalist project. Mm-hmm. But of course, the homeland of the Zionists is the historical biblical homeland of the Jews. And so for us as Christians, where you talk about Christian Zionists, a Christian Zionist is someone who thinks that there is some sort of theological, biblical, or divine significance to the return of the Jewish people to their historic homeland. And so I'm paraphrasing that definition from a scholar named Gerald McDermott in his book, The New Christian Zionism. But in general, that's what Zionism is. And so, you know, if you're saying that Zionism is racism, what you are effectively saying is that for Israel to not be a racist society, it would have to no longer exist as a Jewish state. Now, even Zionists don't always agree on what we mean when we say a Jewish state, but Zionism is just to say the state has that Jewish character. And so anti-Zionism is the belief then that there ought not to be a state of Israel that has a distinctively Jewish character in the historic and biblical homeland of Israel. So, you know, I think we sometimes obscure this definition of Zionism, but it is actually very clear. It is very simple, and it comes right to the heart of the existence of the state of Israel as a Jewish state.
Dr. Nolte, as you continue to develop programs and classes for the Institute for Israel Studies there at Regent, What are some of the biggest misunderstandings that you hope to address in terms of course load?
I would say from our perspective, the biggest one is actually the one that we talked about, the nature of Zionism, trying to educate folks to understand exactly what Zionism is. And that leads into my second huge misconception that's being spread, the idea that Israel is an apartheid state. It is very clearly not. And I think if we educate people about the reality that Arab citizens of Israel are in many ways better off than Arab citizens of almost any other state in the Middle East, if we educate people about the fact that Israel is the only country since 1948 that has increased the size of its Christian population, and those are, you know, indigenous Christians in the Middle East primarily, those factors, I think, are important things for us to understand. And those are certainly not things that we would have seen under the horrendous apartheid regime of South Africa. And then I think the third component of that is there's a perception out there that the only reason that you as a Christian would care about Israel is because you have a certain kind of eschatology, and that Israel is a means to an end in that sense. And so part of it is getting evangelicals to understand, look, there are lots of reasons, and we're not picky about theologically why you support Israel. As an empirical fact, Christians support Israel for a lot of reasons. Oftentimes because they see it as a sign of the character of God and God's faithfulness, but also to get non-Christians to understand there is a really different, important theology that takes the Jewish people seriously because it takes the Old Testament seriously and that has a love and respect for the Jewish people and sees a sign of God's faithfulness in their return to the land. And so that support for Israel is not going to go away, and it will remain strong. And so I'm hoping that we can strengthen the sense of evangelical, biblically faithful Christians as allies to the state of Israel, and also as allies to our Jewish friends as they are facing this wave of anti-Semitism at home here in the United States.
Yeah. Well, this is incredibly unique, and we are so thankful that you are taking this project on and very excited to see what happens in years to come. If people want to find out more, the website regent.edu is the place to go, regent.edu, and specifically for the Institute for Israel Studies is israelinstitute@regent.edu. Dr. A.J. Nolte, Chair of the Institute for Israel Studies at Regent University, thank you for being with us today on The Stand Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, we'll hear the fascinating story of an Egyptian-born woman who left Islam and is now sharing the gospel very successfully to Muslim women in Europe. For guest information and resources from today's program, visit our podcast page at afr.net. And you can get a free 6-month trial subscription to The Stand magazine or sign up for the daily email at afa.net/The Stand. Thanks for listening, and join us next time here on The Stand Radio.